pretty well. So, talking about the Victor Miller basis. Victor Miller is a mathematician. I think he got his PhD at Princeton, but I could be wrong. He works at CCR in Princeton. So he works for the government, but he's a number theorist. So he was one of the, so Neil Koblitz and Victor Miller are the co-inventors of elliptic curve cryptography. So that's one of Victor Miller's claims to fame. Okay, so that's it for the next 2 days, and now I'll keep going. So finally, this is the first example of an interesting modular form in this class. So far, I haven't given any examples at all, really, and gone into detail, except for constant functions. So fix an integer k that's greater than or equal to 4, and consider, well, let's make it even as well. Even integer greater than or equal to 4. And now consider the following function. This is a function on the extended upper half plane, that is the complex upper half plane union rational numbers union a point which you can think of at infinity along the y-axis. And here's the function, sum over pairs of integers m to n. The star, I'll explain the meaning of the star in a minute. 1 over mz plus n to the power k. And the meaning of the star is the following. Well, in the case when z happens to be in p1 of q, say z is a rational number, then there's exactly one choice of m and n such that this is 0. Is that true? Mod scalars, so up to scalar multiplication. Well, there are a whole bunch, I guess. There's a line of choices of m and n, where mz plus n is 0. So star means to not include those in the sum. So the star has no makes no difference when z is in the upper half plane, because then z will never this will never be 0, because if this is 0, that means that z is equal to minus n over m, which is a rational number. But when z is in the extended upper half plane, but not in the upper half plane, then you have to omit some things from the sum. But it's an infinite sum, defines a function. You choose a specific value of z, you could plug it in, you add this up, you get a convergent series, and that defines a function.
I suppose we should always omit 0, 0.
Sorry, that's true. You also want to omit 0, 0. So that is important when z is in the upper half. Thank you. So again, star means omit. Thank you very much for that comment. Omit m and n with mz plus n equal to 0. Thanks, that's a very good point, and I had not said that. But if I just say this, it takes care of everything. So, fact, g sub k is a holomorphic function on h star. I'm not going to prove this fact, but I will prove for you. Now that I've stated it as a fact, I won't say anything more about it. I will prove that it is a modular form of level 1. So that is proposition 211. GK is a modular form of level 1. That is to say, a modular form on SL2Z. So this is an element of MK SL2Z. I'll just leave off the SL2Z for right now. And here's the proof. So the way I'm going to do this is, well, I have to show that for every element of SL2Z, that GK bar gamma k is equal to gk for all gamma in SL2z. But fortunately, SL2z is generated by two elements, and it suffices to check this for those two generators. And well, we'll just do that. So check on generators. And again, the reason it suffices to check on the generators, check this condition on the generators, is because this bar gamma k action is a right action of SL2z on functions on the upper half plane. Okay, so I'll check it on generators. So one of the generators is 0, minus 1, 1, 0. And this sends z to the linear fractional transformation defined by this sends z to minus 1 over z. So if you unwind what that means, it says that z to k minus z to the minus k f of minus 1 over z, this is supposed to be equal to f of z. That's just rewriting what's written over here. So you just take the infinite sum over there, replace z by minus 1 over z, do a little bit of algebra, multiply it all out, and see if you get something that tells you that this is true. Okay, so here the f is, of course, just gk. So I'll take gk, and we'll put minus 1 over z in, and see what we get. So you simply take this sum and replace z by minus 1 over z. Now to simplify, to get something that looks like it involves gk again, multiply top and bottom by z to the k, and you get, again, just multiply top and bottom by z to the k and factoring out that z to the k again, z to the k sum over m and n in z 1 over, since I factored out the z to the k, minus m plus n z to the k. All to the power of k.
It's just z inside the parentheses.
Just z. Oh, not z to the k. Yes. Right, because I'm multiplying through by z inside it. I'm multiplying top and bottom by z to the k. So inside the parentheses, it's just z. Yes. Okay, so you get this. And notice that this thing right here, though we call the letters m and n, you're really summing over exactly the same infinite sum. It's just in a slightly different order, if you like, even though I haven't specified the order. The order doesn't matter. So this is equal to z to the k, g sub k of z. Just because the collection of integers minus m and n is the same as the integers that you get when we sum this way. And that tells us that gk of minus 1 over z is z to the k times gk of z, which is exactly the equality we wanted. The difference is the z to the k is on the other side of a different power. But if you just take this and multiply both sides by z to the minus k, then you get this right here. So that tells us that gk is invariant under one of the two generators of SL2z. Now we do exactly the same sort of calculation, but for the other generator of SL2z. So take gk of z plus 1. Here I'm using this matrix, 1, 1, 0, 1. It's an SL2z. And together, this matrix, along with the matrix of order 4 over there, generate SL2z. So let's just see what happens here. We have to verify, again, this condition, which gk bar gamma k, or gamma is equal to this matrix, is just the same as gk of z plus 1, because the cz plus d thing doesn't contribute anything. So what we want to show is that this is gk of z. That is to say that gk is periodic of period 1. If you replace z by z plus 1, you get back the same thing. And that's easy to see. This is given by the infinite sum over m and n in z of 1 over n z, m, the quantity z plus 1 plus n to the power of k. So all I've done is replaced z by z plus 1 here. But notice, if you multiply out the bottom, you get 1 over mz plus m plus n to the power of k. And again, as you run through all possibilities for m and n in the integers, the linear combinations of z and 1 that you get here are exactly the same as the linear combinations you got before. That's because one way to think about it is the map m comma n to m comma m plus n is invertible over the integers. It's an invertible map from z cross z to itself. So this is again equal to gk of z. So we verified invariance of gk under both generators of SL2z. So since this is a right action of the group on functions on the upper half plane, we know that gk is invariant under everything. And since I'm just stating this holomorphic part as a fact, which you can look at in this book, you see that gk is a modular form of level 1. Now, if you have two modular forms on a group and you multiply them together, I think this was one of the exercises, the product is a modular form. It's just multiplication of two things preserves holomorphicity and holomorphicity at the cusps, and it also, this action business is preserved as well. So you now have a way of constructing lots of modular forms of level 1. Take any two Eisenstein series and multiply them together. Likewise, addition of modular forms of the same weight is again a modular form of that weight. So now you have a way of getting this whole algebra of modular forms of level 1. And the amazing thing, which is the main theorem I want to prove in the next two lectures, is that that gives you all modular forms of level 1. Theorem, or it's called the structure theorem, the sum over k, over all k of mk SL2z is equal C adjoint G4, but even better than what I just said, even we only need two of the Eisenstein series, C adjoint G4 and G6. Okay, so this is the main thing I want to prove now. That's the thing that we're going for. Okay, here's an outline of the way that you get a handle on this theorem and prove it. What you do is you prove it first for a couple of small k's. Prove it for k up to 12. And you can do that using the valence formula, which gives you some tricks that allow you to show that there's a very small number of modular forms of small weight. Once you have the theorem, the statement, the piece of it for k up to 12, then what you do is you use a function called delta, which we'll construct in terms of g4 and g6, and it gives an isomorphism. The multiplication by delta gives an isomorphism between modular forms of weight k and cusp forms of weight k plus 12. So you get a nice one-to-one, you get a nice isomorphism between those two spaces. And the cusp forms of a given weight is a codimension one subspace of everything, where the complementary, or a complementary subspace is given by the space spanned by the corresponding Eisenstein series. So that's pretty much what goes into the theorem. We can figure out what happens for small weights and then use an induction to get everything. So in order to really get going there, you need to know about delta. So delta. This is a modular form of weight 12 and level 1. It's in fact a cusp form. A very, very famous modular form. In some sense, the first cusp form that you might consider ever. And here's how we can get at it. Well, here's the definition. It's 40 G4 cubed minus 27 times 140 G6 squared. And if you think this formula looks something like the discriminant formula for a cubic, you're right, and I'll show you why. But this is the definition of delta. So let me do a little background that explains why this is, in fact, the discriminant of something. And just to motivate maybe a little some of the normalizations that we'll use, it turns out that this delta has Q expansion, Q product 1 minus Q to the n, n greater than or equal to 1 to the power 24. Okay, so I'm just going to tell you a little bit of a couple of things that are in, for example, both in Alford's book on complex analysis, or most good books on complex analysis. But first, let's just make a little observation. It would be nice to know this is, in fact, a cusp form. Because the level is 1, there's just one cusp. And a cusp form, that's a modular form that vanishes at all of the cusps. So there's just one cusp. That's a modular form that vanishes at that one cusp. And to say it's a cusp form, again, for level 1, just means that the Q expansion starts with Q. There's no constant term. In other words, delta of I infinity is equal to 0. So why is that? Well, in order to compute delta of I infinity, it suffices to compute G4 of I infinity and G6 of I infinity.
So let's see what those are.
Well, this is really, by definition, the limit as z goes to I infinity of G4 of z. And that's the limit as z goes to I infinity of, well, just use the definition, sum over n and m, 1 over mz plus n to the power of k. Now, if m is non-zero, this summand in the infinite sum here will go to zero as z goes to infinity, because it's just 1 over something that goes to infinity. So this is equal to the sum over n and m in integers, but we're excluding every single m, which is non-zero, so m equal to 0, of 1 over n to the k. And again, we limit n equals 0. And that is your friendly neighborhood zeta function, twice. So it's 2 zeta of k. It's 2 because you're summing over both the positive and negative integers. And by the way,
no, zeta of s is sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, 1 over n to the s, the Riemann zeta function.
Actually, just sorry. Do something for gk.
This is true. There's no reason to restrict to 4. GK, everywhere else it's a K. So, this thing which I was, I guess, doing for 4 is, in fact, true for any K. Greater than or equal to 4, even. So, there you are. The value, the constant coefficient, or the value of GK at infinity, is given by this special value of the zeta function at a positive integer.
So another way of looking at this is that gk will have a q expansion, and that q expansion will start out 2 zeta of k, and then there'll be some coefficient of q and some higher order terms.
Now, the relevance for seeing that delta is a cusp form is that, well, we just compute. Delta of I infinity is, we simply plug into this 40 zeta of 4, actually 2 times zeta of 4, cubed minus 27. 140 times 2 zeta of 6 squared. And zeta of 4 and zeta of 6, these are known exactly in terms of various things. So, for example, well, you know, zeta of 2 is pi squared over 6, but zeta of 4 we also know.
Pi to the 4 over 96.
I added the 6.
Yeah, so,
and I don't remember the 6. I don't remember the factor. So. There's what this one is, and this one, 140, and then here you get 2 over 3 cubed pi of 7 times pi to the 6. And you have pi to the 4th cubed, pi to the 6th squared, so you just do the arithmetic, everything cancels out, and you get 0. Which I won't do here. So that tells you that delta is a cusp form, because it's a difference of two modular forms of the same weight, hence it's a modular form. And these two are both modular forms again, because products of modular forms are modular forms. So we've now constructed a cusp form.
Now, why is it called delta? The reason is the following. Suppose you consider a lattice lambda in the complex numbers. So by that I mean it's a subgroup of the complex numbers that's free of ring 2 over, in other words, it's isomorphic to z cross d. And if you take the R span of it, you get all of the complex numbers. So a typical example of a lambda is lambda equals z plus zi. So that's a good example of a lambda. And since it has ring 2, you can always give it by giving generators omega 1 and omega 2. And possibly by switching the order, you can assume that omega 1 divided by omega 2 is in the upper half plane. So such that omega 1 divided by omega 2 is in the upper half plane. For example, this is the wrong order, because 1 divided by I is minus I, which is not in the upper half plane. But if you put things in the other order, then if your omega 1 is I, your omega 2 is 1, notice that the omegas don't have to be the upper half plane, just the quotient of the 2 is in the upper half plane. And the reason I do that is because I want to make sense of, in a sense, evaluating a function on the upper half plane at a lattice. And the way to do that is to take the basis and then take the quotient, which is in the upper half plane. Okay, so now, if you have a lattice, lambda in the complex numbers, you can consider C, the modulo of that lattice, and this is a complex torus. It's complex and analytically an elliptic curve. So this is an elliptic curve over C.
Oh, before you should be 60.
Where?
What's wrong? The 40G4 in all these places should be 60. You have it right in the notes, but...
Oops. I just miscopied it. You're right, 60 minutes. I have no idea where I got the 40. Copied it into my brain and copied it onto the board. Okay, so yeah, thank you very much for the.
So, Steve?
James. So it's a complex torus, and it really, so when I say it's elliptic over C, I mean that it's analytically isomorphic to the group of points on a one-dimensional abelian variety, on something given by a Weierstrass equation that has a group law, something algebraic. So that's, by the way, not true for two dimensions bigger than one. There are complex tori of higher dimension, that is where you take a higher dimensional complex vector space and wad up by a lattice, that have no algebraic interpretation. There's no way to find a complex analytic isomorphism between the complex, a certain higher dimensional complex tori and an algebraic variety. But in dimension one, it's always possible. So, it's something you find, for example, in L4's complex analysis. And the answer is the following. If you define the Weierstrass P function of the lattice lambda, which is a function of on the complex numbers, which is denoted with the name Weierstrass P, and it's by definition just 1 over u squared plus the sum over even integers greater than or equal to 4 of k minus 1 times g sub k of omega 1 divided by omega 2 times u to the k minus 2. Okay? I just defined via an infinite sum a function of the complex numbers. You give a specific complex number u, and it outputs for you a number or possibly infinity. It has poles. So we have to watch off of that. For example, at 0, it has a pole. It has a pole, in fact, has poles at all of the lattice points, all the points in the lattice. For everything not in the lattice, you get a perturbative complex number. And the amazing thing is that this P function is the solution to a differential equation, namely this differential equation. P prime squared equals 4p cubed minus 60 g4 of omega 1 over omega 2 times p minus 140 g6 of omega 1 over omega 2. So that's a differential equation. It's an equation involving a function and its derivative. And P is, since I've written it down in terms of P, P is a solution to this. Why that's so is a great topic for another course. And I shouldn't go into a lot of detail about it, but it's in fact true. And the nice thing is that this is also the equation of an affine algebraic variety, only a curve, y squared equals 4x cubed minus 60x minus 140. So this is an equation for an elliptic curve. You could take the projective closure if you like, but this is the affine equation for an elliptic curve. And the fact that P satisfies this equation tells you that you have a map from the complex numbers to a set of solutions, set of points on this elliptic curve. And it sends a point, say u, in the complex numbers to P of u, comma, P prime of u. It's a well-defined analytic isomorphism. It actually passes to a map from C mod lambda. The Weierstrass P function is periodic with respect to the lattice lambda. So you, in fact, get a map from C mod lambda to E of C, where when you evaluate the Weierstrass P function at the elements of lambda, you get a pole, and that goes to the point at infinity, which is the origin for the elliptic curve. And this is an isomorphism. So what's the connection with delta? Well, this elliptic curve, with its Weierstrass equation, in particular with this thing on the right, has a discriminant, and...
I think the 60, you should still have the g4 thing.
Yeah.
It should be 60.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, definitely. Those are the coefficients of C. Yeah. Thank you very much.
G4.
The thing that you replace by x is p of x. Thank you. X minus 140. G6. I'll take a 1 and a negative. I mean, for example, if you want to computationally find this elliptic curve, what you do is you compute as efficiently as possible g4 on this and g6 on that. And what you do is you actually use the invariance properties that g4 has, since it's a modular function, to replace omega 1 over omega 2 by another element of the upper half plane for which the series that you use to compute g4 converges very quickly. And you figure out how that changes the g4 that you're computing by changing this point, so you can actually compute this efficiently. That's described in detail in John Komoda's book, Algorithms for Elliptic Curves, for modular elliptic curves. So the connection with the discriminant is that the discriminant of this cubic on the right-hand side is 16 times the function delta that I just defined, evaluated at omega 1 over omega 2. So in fact, the cusp form delta is really the function which gives you for, if you choose a lattice lambda, then you have a basis omega 1 comma omega 2 for that lattice, then you have the corresponding elliptic curve. That elliptic curve has a discriminant, and basically up to the scalar, delta is giving you the discriminant of the elliptic curve, of the Weierstrass equation for the elliptic curve. And if you changed your choice of omega 1 and omega 2, then you would get a different model for the elliptic curve, and the discriminant would change, but the change is exactly compensated for by delta being a modular function. Because delta is a modular form, you know how it transforms if you change this. Notice if you change the basis for omega 1, if you change the basis for lambda, what are you doing? You're applying an element of SL2z, an invertible integer linear transformation, to this rank 2 modulus. You'll get, any other basis for lambda is of the form z a omega 1 plus b omega 2 plus z c omega 1 plus d omega 2. That's any choice of basis is of that form. And if you want to have the condition that the first basis vector divided by the second basis vector is still in the upper half plane, then you need a condition on A, B, C, and D. Right now, if they're just an arbitrary transformation, A, B, C, and D, they form a 2 by 2 integer matrix with determinant that's a unit in Z, namely plus 1 or minus 1. But the condition that the quotient A omega 1 plus B omega 2 divided by C omega 1 plus D omega 2, the condition that that's again in the upper half plane is exactly the condition that this has positive determinant. So all the different choices of a basis for lambda correspond to taking the image of this basis under the action of SL2z. And if you consider delta at A omega 1 plus B omega 2 divided by C omega 1 plus D omega 2, that is, you choose a different basis for your lattice, then what have you done here? Well, if you just divide top and bottom by omega 2, you notice that this is delta of A omega 1 over omega 2 plus B over C omega 1 over omega 2 plus D. So you're just applying a linear fractional transformation defined by the matrix A, B, C, D to the omega 1 over omega 2 that you started with over here. So you know what this is equal to, since delta is a modular form. This is C omega 1 over omega 2 plus D to the minus 12 delta of the original omega 1 over omega 2. And let's just, it's just the ambiguity in how you choose a basis is exactly what delta being modular sort of explains. So it's not, if you change the equation for an elliptic curve, then change the discriminant in some well-defined manner. And that's what delta being modular means. That if you change the basis that you use for your lattice, hence changing the Weierstrass equation, you change the discriminant by a 12th power in a well-defined way, in a precise way. Okay, so that's delta. Delta is a weight 12 cuspidal modular form. It is related to the discriminant of the elliptic curve given by a complex lattice. Oh, one other observation that's very important, and I'll use a lot later, is that, well, if you have a function on the upper half plane, you might ask, what are its zeros? Because perhaps you want to divide by your function, and you'd like to know what poles are introduced. And it turns out delta has only one zero in the extended upper half plane, namely, has a simple zero at infinity. That's the only place it has a zero. So the reason it doesn't have any zeros in the upper half plane, in non-extended upper half plane, just the usual upper half plane, is because delta is the discriminant of the Weierstrass equation of an elliptic curve. And this, because this is an elliptic curve, the discriminant is non-zero. So for any point in the upper half plane, delta is non-zero. And we just saw a minute ago that delta at infinity is zero. So there's only one place where it can have a zero, namely at infinity. And the only thing I haven't explained is that that is a simple zero, as opposed to a zero of higher order. This is a simple zero. I will wait to prove that delta is a simple zero. That's going to be an application of the valence formula a little bit later. So it'll be an application of the residue theorem. But let me at least state what I just said. Delta has exactly one zero in H star, namely at infinity. So because discriminants of Weierstrass equations of elliptic curves are non-zero. The discriminant of elliptic curve is not equal to zero.
Okay. All right. Great, so I have only a few minutes left, and what I'll do now is state the Fourier expansion of the Eisenstein series. So this is proposition 215. And by Fourier expansion, I mean the Q expansion, the power series expansion at infinity of the Eisenstein series. And it's simple, dk of z. So I defined it using an infinite sum, but over, it was a good sum from the point of view of proving that GK is a modular form. But it's a bad sum from the point of view of working with GK for almost anything else. So here's a good formula from the point of view of trying to prove other things about GK once you know it's a modular form. So GK of Z, it's 2Z zeta of K plus something. So I already showed you that part. And the something is 2 times 2 pi I to K over k minus 1 factorial sum, n equals 1 to infinity, sigma sub k minus 1 of n, q to the n. So up to a constant factor out front, the coefficients of the q expansion of the weight k Eisenstein series are exactly the sum of the k minus first powers of the divisors of n. So Eisenstein series are essentially the generating functions for the function, the k minus first power is an integer. So if you've ever been interested in k minus first, or the sum of odd powers of an integer, well, you've been interested in coefficients of the Eisenstein series. Okay. Why is this so? Well,
I'm not going to give the proof of this. It's given in complete detail in Sarah's book. It's completely readable. All he does is, I mean, it's basically something you could do in calculus almost. He takes an identity for pi cotangent of pi z and manipulates it a whole bunch and is able to see that this is true. So again, I refer you to Sarah's book. So it just uses an identity for it. For I cotangent of I z. So my notes have a whole bunch about Bernoulli numbers, and I'm going to do that next time. And since I won't actually need that for the structure theorem, the last thing I want to do is state the valence formula. So here's the complex plane, and in the complex plane, there's a subset, which, here this is I, let's plane here is rho, which is e to the 2 pi I over 3, and this is a fundamental domain for the action of SL2z, as I mentioned before. Because time is up, I won't state the valence formula, but I'll do that first thing next time, and I'll do a bunch of applications. But it just tells you something about how the zeros and poles of the function are distributed. All right, so I'll start with this, the valence formula, and I'll prove the structure there first thing on Friday. And then I'll talk about Bernoulli numbers. Yes, please turn in your homework right now. And I did not make up the homework for next time, and I'll give that out on Friday. Okay.
The homework would just be the exercises you've done.
Yeah, except I might add a few. But basically, it'll be the exercises for chapter 2. Thank you. Wow, nicely typed.
Well, you wouldn't want my hand out.
Oh. I could include a solutions guide with the book. So if you keep typing up solutions, that would be really good.
Might be scary.
Yeah, that could be scary.
So you can ask Ludwig to put this book on.